Welcome to Authors First on the Artists First World Radio Network, artistsfirst.com. Tony Kay in the studio. Thanks for joining us, audience worldwide. All broadcasts available free on demand. Be sure to share our content with everyone you know on your social network sites. This hour, it's my privilege to introduce author Brian Swain, S-W-A-I-N. He is an Amazon.com bestseller, incredible, five stars all the way through. It's his fourth book, Sistina, the title. For your convenience, we have the link placed at artistfirst.com, and if you're there, you'll see Dr. Oz and Audrey Landers and Don Wells, and in the center column, and then, of course, on the left, the links for our guest on Authors First. Questions or comments, don't send them to me. Send them to our guest. Thanks a lot for supporting the arts, Brian, and being our guest this hour. How you doing?
Doing excellent, Tony. Thanks for having me on, and I appreciate it. It's this is the very first interview I have done for this new book, Sistina. So any questions you have that I don't know the answer to, now you know why.
Well, you know, many great authors come to us from the state of Maine. I wonder why.
Okay. Well, you know, there's one fellow up there that lives up in Bangor that you may have heard of who has sold a few books. A fellow goes by the name of Stephen King.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there's something in the water. I don't know. I'm trying to think. It's funny you say that. I'm trying to think off the top of my head of other Maine authors. I'm sure there are some.
Brian Swain.
Well, that's true.
From Brunswick. Yes.
Yeah. I am from Brunswick. That's big. Two things that people might know about Brunswick is Bowdoin College and what used to be a large Navy base there. But that's where I was. I had the good or the bad fortune, depending on your point of view, of being one of those people who grow up their entire childhood in not only the same town but the same exact house.
But you know, you followed someone's advice because you went into engineering and completed your bachelor's and a master's degree. Is it electrical engineering then?
It is, actually, and I did that in a sort of an unusual way. I actually went from high school into the Air Force. And then after 6 years of that, at the lofty age of 24, that's when I decided
wow.
to go to college.
Yeah, you were an old guy sitting in those mm-hmm. chairs with those high school students.
That's exactly right. But I pulled through, so that's a good thing.
Well, congratulations, and thank you for applying yourself professionally. Is that how you landed in Texas?
Actually, it is not. I went to college in New York and then worked in New Jersey for several years, and then came to Houston for work. I guess it's work related. Yeah, I came to Houston for work, and then made my way to San Antonio area about 3 years ago. So I joke with people that I'm slowly working my way south. And I guess that makes the next stop
Austin
or something. No. Austin is actually somewhat north of us. So I would have to go to I'd have to go down to the valley, you know, the Rio Grande Valley or something like that.
Oh boy! Well, be careful. Don't take any guns.
No, not so much.
Our own people would shoot you.
There you go.
I love the great state of Texas, and howdy to all of my kinfolk down there in Dallas-Fort Worth. And I'm looking forward to having you up for the wedding in May and then the family reunion in July. So, yeah, we've got them spread out all over the place, California and way up north, too, and all the way to another continent in Australia. And probably, wow. Brian, you've got something to say about that. I think you have some siblings scattered elsewhere.
I do. We're one of those families that ended up in all sorts of far-flung places. So I'm the one who headed south. I have three sisters in Fort Collins, Colorado, in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, in a little town called Gwynn, and then actually in Maine, close to up in Boothe Bay Harbor, Maine, close to where we grew up. So they are putting up with the snow and the bad weather and the I guess the trendy term is the polar vortex. That's what we used to just call winter, but now it's shaping up to be a bit of a cold one and a bit of a snowy one. So down here we get excited if it falls below 50 degrees. So that's
yeah. Okay, emailers, yes, yes. It's Brian Kenneth Swain, S-W-A-I-N. You found the right guy, okay? I should have provided another link, Brian. Is there an additional website they need to be aware of?
Well, my site is what you just said. It's BrianKennethSwain.com, S-W-A-I-N.
Oh, that's not the one I'm using, but yes, go ahead.
Oh, it's not? Okay. And if you search on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any of the usual sites with that full name, you'll find me as well. I'm not sure what you would get if you just search for Brian Swain without the Kenneth, but...
Yeah,
all three.
Hey, you know, branding is everything as an author today, using the World Wide Web. You're on internet radio, which means anyone on planet Earth, overseas, anywhere, has a computer or the proper cell phone, Android, whatever, they can listen to the show and do, including TuneIn.com and YouTube. You'll find authors who've been interviewed here place their shows on other locations for free on-demand listening and significantly improve their exposure. Congratulations, Brian Kenneth Swain, for joining Artist First Radio, contributing to the arts, and being our guest this hour. And on your fourth novel, it's a serious book. I think it's nearly 300 pages, isn't it?
Yeah, it's. I tend to stay in that sort of 100,000-ish word. It's kind of a sweet spot for most fiction that you'll find out there is sort of in that realm, unless you're, you know, like I said, Stephen King, and then you write 800-900-page books. But I haven't given into that temptation yet.
Well, you know, if to have a good book, 300 pages, or you know, that's a nice novel, I think, especially if you can keep turning them pages. And man, people are loving your book. They're loving it. We should probably go back in time. World Hunger was the first?
World Hunger is the first novel, and it's now probably, gosh, I'm going to say 8 or so years old.
Yeah.
That was about GMOs, and it was sort of one of the fellows that I enjoy reading a great deal is Michael Crichton, and it's sort of in the line of the kinds of things he writes. It's technology-based, but it's about... you know, microbiology.
My 5-year-old grandchildren, Brian, know what GMOs are.
Oh, good.
Yeah, then they're 5 and they know. No GMOs.
Wow. Yeah. Well, and as far as I know, it's pretty much the only piece of fiction out there, long fiction, that has GMOs as its topic.
Wow.
So it was a lot of fun putting together it was interesting. I did several interviews for that book as well, and invariably those conversations were less about the novel per se, and they were more about just the subject of GMO, because it's something that people feel very very passionate about one way or another, particularly when you get into Europe and the UK and places like that. So it was a little bit of a departure for me, because I don't come from a biology background or anything like that.
Well, but engineering, it's, you know, to me, it's all the same.
It is. It's technical in that sense. And the second novel, the one that came after that called Alone in the Light, actually plays much more to my background in the engineering space, because it really is about similar kinds of things to what I have actually worked.
Exactly. You know, organized systems, things that have consequences. One thing must be connected to the other. And World Hunger, you show that universality.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's right. I mean, it's granted it is fiction, so I certainly took some liberties with what sorts of things could happen in a GMO type of scenario, because a lot of fiction is what could go wrong types of scenarios. So I played up pretty heavily. You know, what could go wrong if enough bad things happened in a GMO testing type of situation, what could conceivably be the outcome? But it's based on, you know, it's based on a lot of good hard science. So it's not, it doesn't stretch the bounds of credulity too awful much, at least I hope not.
Well, yeah, genetically modified organisms are those things that we've created that don't replicate themselves. You know, every seed after its own kind is nature's way.
Well, you say don't replicate themselves. I mean, there are ways in which they actually can, and in fact, that's one of the several problems potentially with that technology is an inability to actually control what happens, which of course is the foundation for writing that story. So you hear people talk, when they talk about GMOs, you hear people talk about super weeds. And what they mean by that is that the trait that you engineered into your plant, your soybean, your corn, whatever it is, somehow accidentally makes its way into the thing that you're not trying to grow, which is the weed, and then makes it that much more difficult to kill. So it is a story about unintended consequences, I think, as much as anything else.
And I think there's a generational issue, don't you? I mean, it's sort of like the Starbucks generation, if I could use that analogy.
Yeah, it's generational, and it's also geographic. I mean, there are parts of the world where they're just absolutely opposed to anything GM, and I'm thinking of Western Europe in particular. And then there are parts of the world, notably places where, you know, hunger has been an issue for a long time, like India, Southeast Asia, and parts of Africa and so forth, where they're not so focused on the potential long-term health concerns that other people might have, and they're more concerned with, look, I can get a greater yield out of an acre of land, and so, if I have to choose between having more food today and potentially having a health issue 10 years from now, you know what, I'll take the food today. So it's, how people feel about that sort of technology really is a function of where they live and where they have come up. And, do they actually have the luxury from their lifestyle of worrying about things like long-term health as opposed to, where's my next meal coming from?
World Hunger, by our guest this hour, Brian Kenneth Swain. If you have an interest in that topic or know someone in your family, certainly what a great buy on Amazon. And, I love to tell our listeners that, look, when you come to Artists First, you're going to get the best. Well, then now buy 10. You know, there's birthdays, there's graduations. Come on.
And a late Christmas present. How about that?
A late Christmas. There's always a good time for a good read. And when you have an author of this caliber, Brian Kenneth Swain, you won't be disappointed. They're page turners, okay? And in World Hunger, you were finding your voice as a novelist too, which I think is interesting. You've always had love of literature and, I believe, poetry.
I do, actually. I was writing poetry long before I ever sat down and began writing either short or long fiction. So I've enjoyed, and I continue to do that. It's a handy thing. You hear people talk frequently. You hear writers talk about writer's block, and I think if you just are doing one thing, like writing novels or writing fiction, that could be a bit of an issue. But if you're broad enough to be trying to do short fiction, long fiction, poetry, essays, whatever it is, and you find yourself hung up on one thing, there's always another project you can go try to spend your time on. And so I find that if I hit a dead spot in fiction, I can go, spend a few days trying to do something on the poetry side.
Thinking about coming on Artist First Radio with Tony Kaye, making your worldwide debut here, and in the company of so many great professionals, artists, authors, musicians, performers, entertainers. You know, when you think about now, here you are, Brian, in this company of supporting the arts and joining our ranks. It's a big thing. I thank you for that. Having a quality author, someone who has taken their craft seriously, bringing us a page turner book, it's very exciting to our listeners, and I want to thank you, Brian, for working so hard and finding that voice. There's a temptation, I think, would have been a temptation to incorporate poetry in your novel.
I haven't, I'm trying to think back, I haven't actually done much of that yet. I guess the closest I came to that would be probably in Sestina. One of the main sort of plot points in Sestina is the discovery of this Latin inscription And that's actually got kind of a poetic element to it, particularly when late in the book they actually translate this inscription and they discover what it actually means. It definitely has a poetic sort of twist to it. But that's probably about the only time that I've actually made explicit use of that background in on the fiction side. And it's a interesting sort of story, since I don't know boo about Latin. In the course of writing this, I was forced to get my hands on an expert who knew something about Renaissance era Latin. And fortunately, here at the University of Texas at San Antonio, they have a classics department, and there was a fellow there who was able to help me with that. So I owe him a
what fun!
I owe him. What's that?
What fun! Howdy out there!
Exactly. Well, you get to learn. You know, one of the best things for me about writing fiction is the times, even almost more so than the writing, is the time spent researching and learning about the thing that you're writing about. And that, you know, whether it's GMOs and world hunger, or you know, liquid natural gas and Alone in the Light, or the Renaissance frescoes in Sistina, none of those are things, you know, that I or probably very many readers come into it knowing a heck of a lot about. And so the opportunity to spend time now mercifully online, you know, I guess 30 years ago we would have been doing this in a card catalog in a library. But it's, you know, half of the fun is learning about this stuff. And one of the things that I try to do in the course of the writing is strike a decent balance between the sort of educational part of it and the telling a good story part of it. So that's kind of my objective or my goal in the thing. And in the case of Sistina, you know, you'll come away learning about the process of how Michelangelo created frescoes in the Sistine Chapel. So, you know, that's a not something that's a terribly common piece of knowledge.
7 years from your first novel, World Hunger, to your fourth. And
actually, Sistina is the third. There are three novels. There's another one that's done that's sitting on my shelf, but hasn't been published yet. And then in addition to that, there are two poetry books. And then there's an additional sort of odd bird called The Curious Habits of Man, which is actually an essay collection. So I'm sort of all over the place in terms of format and stuff, which is the kind of approach that drives agents and publishers crazy, because there is a tendency out there, you know, once you've done one thing very successfully, whether it's a Michael Crichton book or a Stephen King book or a 50 Shades of Grey book or a Harry Potter book or whatever it is, there's a very, very strong amount of pressure for you to keep doing that, right?
Oh, yeah.
You establish an audience for your one thing, and so that's what they want to see. If you're John Grisham and you write some book that isn't about a downtrodden Southern lawyer, then, you know, you get a lot of grief from your publicist and your agent.
Do you have a routine of writing then, or do you find that suddenly a concept, an idea emerges, and then you become passionate about it, becomes all-consuming?
Well, that's actually two questions.
Yeah.
The part about the writing, you know, I was listening to the fellow that you were chatting with before, who wrote the children's books, and he made a comment about going for a long time without writing anything, and then sort of being struck by some kind of inspiration, and all of a sudden cranking out a lot. That's pretty much my model as well. I am not the. If you listen to an interview with, for example, Stephen King, I keep coming back to him. He'll tell you that he, you know, rain or shine, 6 days a week, sits down and writes 2,000 words a day. And he doesn't stop until he's, you know, finished writing his 2,000 words. But in my case, it's far less disciplined than that. If you want to think about it that way, it's kind of a when the spirit moves me. And you know, frankly, I have the luxury now of being that way because I'm not writing to a contract where you've taken a check from somebody and you've signed a contract that says, you know, I will have 100,000 words to you by such and such a date. If I ever find myself in that situation, I'm not sure, frankly, how I would react to that. But at the moment, I do have I have the luxury of kind of doing this as and when the spirit moves me.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and then, of course, once you get into it, then the homework begins, right? Fleshing out the details or do your books find a historical setting?
You know, most, I find that in my case, all of the books of the three novels I published and the one and the two that are in partial state of writing, they all stem from a common thing, which is you could summarize in one sentence, which begins with "what if." You know, you sort of, through reading or talking to people or whatever it is, you know, somebody will ask the question, gosh, what would happen if a GMO field test experiment, something went horribly wrong? What could happen? And then you're off to the races after that, because the wheels start turning and you start reading papers and other books about it and all of this, and you start learning things, and that's when you become truly dangerous, because you're typically dealing with you know, topics that, at least in my case, I don't have a strong background in. So I'm out there looking at what would happen if this thing took place, what would happen if that thing took place, and then using that as the sort of the germ of the nucleus of the idea. So in the case of Sistina, for example, the nucleus of the idea was, gosh, what would happen if there was an earthquake in Rome, which happens periodically, and part of the ceiling, the plaster frescoed ceiling of the Sistine Chapel were to fall off, and they were to actually discover something underneath the plaster? What would happen? And that literally, somewhere in my computer, there's a file that has a page, and that's all it says. And then the rest of the idea sort of stems from that. And one of the odd things that I've done over the years that I don't know how common it is, but I tend to work on story and character separately. And I actually keep a list of characters according to a kind of a template. You know, who are they? Where are they from? What are they like? What are they not like? Also, you know, pages of stuff about, you know, about this character.
Background information.
Even though they're not in a story. And then when it comes time to write a story, I will go into that file of characters, and I'll just sort of yank one at random, you know, okay, it's your turn to be in a story, and sort of plunk them down into the middle of this, whatever this horrible situation is that's shaping up.
You know, and then in writing, have you found perhaps that you've shifted gears and you have a different book than you intended?
It's pretty common for me to not, you know, on the one hand, I'm kind of an outline guy, you know, I like to lay out what the chapters are and so forth. But on the other hand, I tend to get pretty deeply into these things and still not really know how it's going to end.
So a character might take off in a way and you maybe didn't originally imagine, and suddenly, or their insignificant character becomes a highly significant and important role later.
They might very well, or conversely, you might get to the end and realize, you know, this person that I've had in here, turns out they actually didn't do much, and so maybe I'm going to go back in and actually strike them from the story, which turns out to be a surprisingly difficult thing to do. They get all intertwined in various plot points, and they cause all sorts of continuity errors. And lucky for me, I have just a wonderful editor that I've worked with for a few years, and she's great at catching all of these continuity issues and logic issues and all of that.
You know, and that's so important, Brian, because it's as plain as the nose on your face, but you can't see it.
It is. And you know, the more, you know, I'm a firm believer that in situations like this, the more you look, the less you see. And, you know, when you're trying to get a book out the door, typically, it doesn't matter who you are, you typically read the thing 10, 15, 20 times, and you get to a point where you just fly past errors.
Every typo.
But not just typos. I mean, actual logical problems. You know, you said such and such on page 200, but that doesn't make sense because the character said some other thing 50 pages earlier. And that's that's actually potentially the more damaging stuff. You know, a typo, you have to do your copy editing and know how to use a comma and all of this sort of thing. But that's quite mechanical, typically. The logic and the continuity and the flow and the arc of the story. You know, when is it calm and when is it excited and all of that. That's a fair bit more difficult, I think. And I think it's harder to teach. I think there are people who just sort of have a knack for that, and there are people who, who don't, and they sort of struggle, and they may become excellent at it, but it may not have been very natural for them. One of the things that you hear from a lot of writers, of course, is that they read a terrific amount, and the benefit of that is, of course, that you're out there forming. You mentioned voice earlier. Your voice, in some regard, is a is an amalgamation of everything you've kind of ever read, right? So you can almost hear that when you read the things that that any particular author does. You could sort of, if you think about it long enough, you can almost pick apart, you know, who do they sort of sound like.
You really enjoy being an author and putting together the book, the research, the time, the planning. It's a passion. It's fun. What's the hard part?
Wow, the hard part is after the first draft is done. The hard part, the fun part is the conceptualization, the research, the putting the story together, the figuring out what the characters are going to do and getting it all down on paper. But once you have that first draft done, to me at least, that's when the work starts, because that's when you have to start the editing and the cleaning up and the fixing of the language and the things I mentioned before, the logic and the continuity and is it too long? Is it too short? You know, are the characters doing consistent things based on who they are and all of that? And some of that comes from, you know, the drafting process, but a lot of it does not, because you're in such a hurry to get the basic story down that you find you have to come back. And, you know, one of the best things, and I'm by no means the only person who does this, I mean, you write the first draft and you just sort of throw it in a binder and you throw it on the shelf. And the best thing you can do is sort of forget about it for a few months, and then come back and read it as though you've never seen it before.
Yeah, time is of no importance.
Things will just jump off the page.
When it's finished, it's going to be out there forever, right, Brian? I mean, so what if you gave it an extra 6 months to work it over? Mm-hmm. And you know, that's true.
Which is not to say you can't re-release a book and fix things, but typically if you do that, you're only fixing typos and line edits and things like that. You're not changing the story.
Yeah. What about the publisher side? Did you decide to self-publish your books?
I did. I have worked, you know, I have, like a lot of independent writers, I've spent many, many years, you know, trying sort of on the sidelines to do the traditional agent publisher thing and never really gotten much traction with that, partly, you know, because of my own tendencies, I think, but partly because it really is a very, gosh, how can I put this without sounding pejorative, but it's a risk-averse industry on that side of things. And there are so many people writing, quite frankly, that if you're an agent, and the agents, the main purpose the agent serves, of course, is they're the gatekeeper between you, the writer, and the publisher. And the publisher takes the agent's word. If they like a book and they pitch it to them, then there must be something to it, right? But it's a very, very difficult, you know, I meet regularly with all sorts of other independent writers. And, you know, every one of us could wallpaper our houses with the rejection slips from agents and so forth. It's a... you know, I when I talk with people about this, I keep coming back to this Dickens phrase about it being the best of times and the worst of times for publishing. And what I mean by that is, compared to 25 or 30 years ago, when your only option was get an agent, get a contract, get a publisher, and do that, and if you couldn't do that, you were sort of done. Now, there are so many options, e-books and self-publishing and print-on-demand and all of this. I mean, there's really no excuse, frankly, for anybody who wants to put a book out there to not be able to do it, because there are options that are, frankly, as inexpensive as free if you want to go down that road.
Yeah, I mean, why produce an album if you could release one song on CD Baby or YouTube?
Exactly. Or, you know, and put it on and have it show up on iTunes, you know, a couple of hours later. Right?
Yeah.
But the flip side of that scenario I was painting a second ago is, because there are so many alternatives available today, there are something like, and you know, my numbers could be off a little bit, but I think in 2014 there was something like 900,000 new books published in the U.S., of which about two-thirds were independently published. So when you write a new book, your ability to cut through all the noise and get publicity, you know, and get the word out and actually get readers is very, very challenging.
Well, it's challenging for us, too.
Avenues like yours are a wonderful opportunity, but you have to do loads and loads of other things, too. And unfortunately, in this day and age, most of the marketing burden falls on the writer. And that's not just true of independent published folks, too. You know, that's true just in large part even for people that have traditional publishing contracts. Typically, those folks will tell you, well, we'll publish your book and we'll give you an advance, but we're really not going to do much to publicize it. You have to go out and beat the bushes and talk to the Barnes & Nobles and do signings and all of these things that, you know, that you kind of wish they would do for you.
Oh, absolutely. Or if they front you money, you still have to earn it, you know.
You do. I mean, they want, you know, and the first book is the challenging one and the important one, right? Because even if you go down the traditional publishing road, all it takes is one perceived failure, you know, and as far as those people are concerned, you're done. You know, if your first book didn't blow the doors off Barnes & Noble, then, you know, they don't tend to want to hear from you after that.
Oh, yeah, it's the money chase, I know. But I love self-publishing. I do, even though there are 900,000 people for me to look at, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We love to bring and offer the Artist First Family quality literature. And thank you, listeners, for joining us and for sharing the content with everyone you know on your social network sites, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, whatever your selections are. Thank you for that. Brian Kenneth Swain, our guest this hour, thanks for contributing to the arts and joining us. We're having a lot of fun. I love it when authors use their name as the website. Audience, BrianKennethSwain.com. When you get over there, you'll see some pop-ups that'll tell you about each one of the books you can select. There's autobiography, and there's a way for you to put in your email. It's just a great interactive Facebook, Twitter kind of website that you can get involved with the author. I didn't see a blog. Do you have that too?
You know, there is also on that site pretty much everything I have done in terms of short writing, whether it's essays or fiction. I didn't put all of the poetry on there. There's some samples of that, but pretty much every essay and story is on there too, if you poke around in those categories. But you know, you mentioned blogging. I don't really do a lot of what you would traditionally call blogging. I mean, when I put something on the site, it's typically a finished actual, you know, piece of writing. It's a story, it's an essay, or maybe it's a chapter from a new book or some sort of thing. But it's not just me sort of opining on a topic or what have you, which is not to say that I shouldn't be doing that, quite frankly. I mean, most of the people I know who write, you know, tell me that they, in fact, do that on a fairly regular basis, daily, weekly, monthly, whatever. I haven't done much of that to this point.
This is a highly charged topic. It's a religious topic.
Mm-hmm.
You were able to utilize some scriptures, and earlier you mentioned the use of Latin and the need to do some research there. Did you find it, as an author, comfortable for you to go into the biblical scriptures and sort of extract and then fictionalize?
Yeah, it's so I mentioned earlier talking about writing in areas where you're not sort of expert, and I am most certainly not a religious individual. However, I grew up in that tradition up in Maine, and so I'm you know, whether or not I choose to make any use of it now, it's part of me simply because of the way I was brought up. But I try to make as much use of not just biblical things, but also Quranic stuff and things from the, you know, the Talmud and as many different religious things as I can, because the topic is one that I find fascinating, quite frankly. I mean, it's something that in some fashion or other something like 90% of the world's population finds compelling for one reason or another, whatever their faith may be. And so this particular book does have a lot of religious themes in it, and it has characters who are monks and priests and cardinals and that sort of thing. And it also has characters who are atheists or agnostic or something in between. And so some of the more interesting parts of the book, for me at least, frankly, were the interactions between these people. You know, how does an art historian who is trying to restore a damaged Sistine ceiling interact with, you know, a Catholic priest or a Catholic cardinal? It's not an obvious it's not an obvious case of simpatico. And so a lot of the kinds of things you could imagine people like that talking about comprise a fair bit of the book. So in addition to the actual plot of the story, many of those kinds of issues are raised, not necessarily, you know, you can't say they're put to bed because there are things that people will be arguing about from now until doomsday, but there are a lot of important theological kinds of debates and discussions are incorporated into that story.
And your attempt even though it's a work of fiction, your attempt, though, is to be realistic. You're not inventing orders and so forth, right?
No, absolutely not. And then, you know, it's one of the main I talked earlier about having the sort of the nucleus of a story or the kernel of a story and then branching out from there. You know, one of the primary germs of this particular story that falls under my what-if scenario that I was talking about earlier is this idea that, okay, you have a piece of Christian theology that involves the crucifixion and the resurrection, but what would have happened or what would happen if, in fact, the resurrection as we know it and the, you know, a big part of Christian theology is not just the resurrection, but the bodily ascension of Christ into heaven after being on earth for a period of time. So what would happen if that, in fact, had not taken place? And in fact, you know, the actual corporeal body of Jesus was, in fact, still on earth. And so the premise, the main plot point of the book is that that's what has happened, and that there's this body of people out there, starting with some of the apostles from Christ's time, who took it upon themselves to actually sort of guard this body and down through the ages, and it carries all the way through the Renaissance and into the present day. So the question is, what would it mean for Christianity in general if it became common knowledge that, in fact, this body was actually here on earth?
You mean Jesus was mummified? Do you put it in those terms?
Yeah, that's a way of putting it. But yeah, I mean, literally his body, as it was, you know, taken care of. You know, you can read the biblical account of Joseph of Arimathea and the sepulcher and all of that, right? And you say, well, what would happen if that body never went anywhere? And so that's what these guys do in the story. There's this organization that actually has possession of this thing, and that's what's tied to the inscription in the Sistine and why the story jumps. And the story actually begins at the time of the crucifixion. And then it very quickly skips ahead 1,500 years to the Renaissance, and then it skips ahead again at about the halfway point to the present day. But the thing they're all dealing with is this earthly body of Christ that this organization is charged with taking care of.
Oh, how exciting! What a revelation that would shake the very foundations of the church, right? I mean, a billion believers worldwide suddenly made aware of this in such a public fashion.
That's one of the questions.
Or do they cover? Right? Are they covering it up though? I mean, it's exposed in the Sistine Chapel. There it is. But is there an attempt to cover it up, or you don't want to tell us that?
The group of people who do this, yeah, their charge, if you like, is to in fact keep this a secret, and that's what they go to enormous lengths to do. The reason for the inscription in the ceiling is that around the time of the Renaissance, you know, the body actually goes missing, and the person who's responsible for the body going missing, who knows where it is, actually has someone, one of Michelangelo's assistants, actually write into the plaster of the ceiling kind of the clue to where this thing is. and then cover it up with the painting. So you say, well, why would anyone, how would anyone ever discover this? And it's purely by accident that they do. It's because of this modern day earthquake that happens that causes some of the painting to actually fall away and sort of reveal this inscription, and then it becomes a big race to see who can figure out what this thing means first.
What a compelling storyline. And anyone faintly familiar with biblical stories of Christ and the apostles and the resurrection and the ascension would right away say, wow, that would be just something if Michelangelo's assistant had covered up or buried this evidence. That's amazing storyline. That's the what if scenario that you love to follow.
Well, it is, and like I said, it started out before it had anything to do with Christ's body or you know, groups of individuals hiding things. None of that. It all just started out as, you know, what if this chunk of the ceiling fell off, and in the process of repairing this, they discovered something underneath. And then it became, you know, then the thought process became, well, what is it they would find underneath, and what would it mean, and why would it be so important that you could build an entire novel around it?
The reviews for the book are outstanding. Congratulations once again with this book. The fourth is coming out, though, later this year.
I'm not sure. The next book, actually, I've kind of gotten into this sort of religious fiction mold, because the next book, which has a working title of Day's End, which no one can get now because it's not published, actually has more to do with what's going on in Jerusalem with the Temple Mount.
And so it involves
Jews and Muslims and Christians all working together sometimes and not so much together other times and so forth and so on. And it was kind of a fun story as well, but it's also got some very fraught sort of religious themes as well. So it's I don't know, two in a row with that kind of theme. I'm not sure quite what to make of that. But that book is, as I say, that book is done and sort of waiting its turn in the queue. But I don't know that it'll make it this year. But it's a possibility.
When you're thinking about this type of a topic and writing a book, there's so many sensitivities, right? You don't want to offend those who have that faith, and yet at the same time, you want them to be engaged in the possibility of this could happen.
You do, and I have a...
It's a balancing act.
You know, it is a balancing act, and you don't want, like you said, you don't want to be offensive, but on the other hand, it's almost impossible nowadays to write anything and not offend someone. And in fact, I have a very good friend in Houston who I talked with in the early days of writing this new one that I was talking about, this Day's End book, who begged me, you know, do not write this book because the essence of this book is a plot to destroy the Dome of the Rock on the Temple Mount. Well, if the day ever came when that happened, you know, that's a big deal for anybody who knows about Jerusalem and what's going on in that part of the world. And like I said, he was not, you know, regardless of who was or was not at fault, just sort of postulating that could even happen was a very, very troubling thing in his particular case. So, like I said, and even in the case of Sistina, there are things in there that people could very well take issue with.
I was just curious if the new Pope, you know, in the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, if that was, you know, current events, things that are broadly in the news religiously, if that plays a bear as you on you as you shape your story.
Well, it does, and it's something that I follow pretty closely. I mean, I'm like I said, I'm despite being not at all a religious person myself, it's a topic I am terrifically interested in, and so I follow it and I subscribe to a number of newsletters and websites and email services from a number of different faiths just to kind of see and understand what's on their radar screen at any given moment, and you know what they do like and what they don't like, and where they come down on political questions and all of this sort of thing. So I have to say ever since Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code, the whole notion of religious fiction has kind of taken on a life of its own, and there's certainly no shortage of of fiction out there, whether it's the Crusades or the Vatican or, you know, pick your favorite topic. There's more than ample fictional ground out there for people to be playing on. And one of the reasons why it works well in many cases is because it is a subject that people feel very passionate about. I mean, one of the best things you can do, I think, as a fiction writer is pick a topic going in that people have, that people will have a reaction to, whether it's a good one or a bad one, almost doesn't matter, but it's something that they're going to feel strongly about.
You know, on a different topic, you're in Texas. I think that Texas has some of the most fantastic poets, poetry. I don't know why. Maybe it's the cowboy, but it really is an exciting.
I know a few of them. You know, it's we've just started in San Antonio a poet laureate program, and of course the state of Texas has had a poet laureate now for several years, and some of those are good friends of mine, and Houston does as well. So it's getting. You know, simply creating that poet laureate program, and many cities and states around the country have it. It's a way of kind of getting the word out. And typically, the individuals who take on those positions use it in educational ways, right? To create literature programs in schools, and to get kids kind of thinking about this stuff from a young age. Because one of the unfortunate states of affairs right now in this country, and I suppose everywhere, is, you know, whereas there is still a pretty good community of people for reading fiction, particularly novels, that is far less true on the poetry side. And you don't see, you know, you publish a book of poetry, you know, and if you sell 100 copies, you know, most people would consider a wild success. You know, and you can name. You say to somebody on the street, you know, name a current living poet that you know, and once they get past Billy Collins, you know, they're likely to quickly run out of gas. It's just not been something that has, and I think part of that is because people feel intimidated by it from a very young age. You know, you go to junior high and high school, and what do you get thrown at you? You get Longfellow and Coleridge and all of this sort of 100, 200-year-old stuff. And it doesn't resonate for a lot of people. And so I think what a lot of these poet laureates have done in San Antonio, you know, no exception, Carmen Tafoya was the first one we had, and now it's Lorianne Guerrero. You know, a big part of that pulpit that they have gotten has been to try to reverse that trend of kids not having that interest by exposing them to it as you know, at a relatively early age.
Brian, thank you for all that you're doing to promote poetry and quality literature where you're at. Thank you for these great books and for supporting the arts and joining us this hour. Before I let you go, anyone out there on planet Earth you'd like to say hello to, or any concluding remarks for our listeners?
I don't know about concluding remarks. I think you touched on a lot of things. Say hey to my beautiful wife, Katia. She's out there listening someplace. My mom and sister in Colorado, my sister in Maine, my sister in Michigan. And, of course, the people that have helped me with this project, my editor, Susan, and the fellow in Columbus I mentioned to you before we started, Ryan, who's busily recording the audiobook as we speak. And several other people weighed in on this thing and had some pretty strong opinions about what the story ought to include. And I'm grateful to all of them. It's a collaborative effort, and we'll see how it goes. It's early days. The book's only been out for a couple of weeks, so we will see what happens. And I appreciate your having me on and the opportunity.